Blog Talk Radio.
Information about me, my articles, and our archive shows from Stand for Truth Radio by going to SusanKnowles.com. Tonight is going to be another great show, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us. I hope everybody out there had a great week. I know it's been a week filled with mountains of news, and we hope to get into a lot of that tonight and talk to our guests about that. We're going to talk about a variety of things tonight. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can either ask your question in the chat room or call in at 347-205-9620. So let's get started. Let me introduce our guest tonight. It's TJ O'Hara. Mr. O'Hara is a political commentator, author, and professional speaker. He has appeared on a wide variety of radio and television programs, both nationally and abroad, including his political commentary on One America News Network. In 2012, Mr. O'Hara was the leading independent candidate for the office of President of the United States. He was honored to receive the Whig Party's first presidential endorsement since the 1850s and achieved the distinction of being named the first virtual president of the United States by the web-based We Want You poll that measured the merit of the candidate's solutions as opposed to their ability to raise and spend money. And obviously today that's a new concept. Mr. O'Hara dominated that poll by receiving 77.91% of the vote as compared to President Obama's 5.81% and Mitt Romney's 5.23%, who finished second and third, respectively. For over 25 years prior to entering the political arena, TJ O'Hara served as a strategic consultant and chief executive who specialized in facilitating corporate turnarounds. He has demonstrated a unique ability to provide situational assessments, identify solutions, and build cross-functional teams and businesses ranging from startups to Fortune 500 companies across high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech sectors. Sounds like a person that we could absolutely use in our government today. So I, without further ado, welcome, TJ. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Susan?
I'm doing just great. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I'm looking forward to talking to you about a lot of different things. And first, before we get started, I wanted to get a little bit of a description of your educational background, where you came from.
I call that my checkered past because I've done a little bit of everything. I have a background in electrical and industrial engineering, as well as a degree like you do, a Juris Doctorate in law. I have taught finance around the nation and done a fairly wide variety of things. So a little bit of science, a little bit of legal background, a little bit of financial background allows me to kind of look at problems from a variety of different directions.
Absolutely. I think somebody with well-rounded background, a lot of experience always, you know, helps a lot than just kind of one thing and just honing in on that. But that's just my opinion. Now, I know you talked a lot on, I looked at your website, and you had talked about your mom and dad and kind of the diverse childhood that you grew up in. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I jokingly say I come from a mixed marriage because my mother was a Democrat, my father was a Republican, and my mother was Italian, my father was Irish. They were kind of at cross purposes with a lot of things, got along wonderfully well, and gave my sister and I just every imaginable opportunity you could give children, at least in our opinion, from a lower middle class background. We weren't born with silver spoons in our mouths, but we were taught an outstanding work ethic and emphasized, when I say emphasized, our parents emphasized the importance of education and the importance of respect. And I think that has gone a great distance towards shaping the person that I am today.
And I noticed, too, that they were also of a different religion. So how did that work in the family?
Yes, we had my mother was Presbyterian. My father was Catholic. As I said, they were at the cross purposes almost every way you could think, but just absolute salt-of-the-earth people and the best parents I could ever hope for.
Wow, that's really nice. Well, let's get right into it now. What in the world possessed you to try to make a presidential run for it in 2012? Let's talk about that and how you came to the decision that you needed to do that.
Well, Susan, I'm going to rely on you. You're the psychotherapist, so. You know, it was funny. I had written three books back in 2010 that were a satirical look at our political condition, and I used satire because I thought people weren't taking it seriously. Our political environment, political issues, and I thought if I used some humor and some sarcasm and so forth, maybe they would read a little bit further. Maybe they would pay a little closer attention. And a strange thing happened. I was on the first syndicated radio show that I did following the publication of those three books. The gentleman who was interviewing me said, "Have you ever considered running for president?" He said, "You know, all kidding aside, you have some really good points and you seem to have a really good grasp. Would you ever run?" And I said, "Absolutely not." Famous last words, right? And
right.
I said I wouldn't run because I was I had too much integrity and I wasn't a clinical narcissist. And he kind of laughed. He said, "Okay, I see your point." But a few years later, no one was stepping up to really address the issues. What we were getting were sound bites rather than solutions. We had people who were caving into their party paradigm And they were, to be direct about it, kind of selling out to partisan politics. And when I look at fundamentally what the oath is about, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, I look at the first three words. That's kind of the Cliff Notes version. It says we the people. It doesn't say we the Democrats or we the Republicans. And yet the
right.
way the major parties select their candidates are people whom they can control. There's an interesting thing that happens when you think about it. We have been running, within the context of both parties, followers rather than leaders. And what I mean by that is you have the economic hurdles that have been used to preclude people from, like me, from making a legitimate run at the presidency. And these hurdles are in place, as well as infrastructure requirements and so forth. So who's attracted? Well, we get back to the clinical narcissism. You have people who are so desperate to have that on their resume that they served as president of the United States that they're willing to do whatever it takes. So they'll follow whatever they're told in return for the $1 billion at this point that it costs and the infrastructure that the parties have in place. So you start looking at it, and they start telling the candidates how to dress, how to comb their hair, whether to dye their hair or not. You know, they orchestrate an image. They create a character. Then they start aligning them with a whole team of pollsters who then parse the data, give that to the political strategist. The political strategist sift through that. They throw away whatever isn't complementary to the party and the candidate, and they retain whatever is. They create sound bites, which they give to a professional team of writers. The writers craft the message based on those bullet points, and what you have is a well-dressed, well-orchestrated actor who's reading from a teleprompter.
Right.
And we never
right.
really are able to test the breadth and depth of a candidate's knowledge. So when I started seeing that, and people started kind of pushing back on me, saying, well, why don't you go out and do something with this? Why don't you try and run and so forth? I started thinking about it. I thought, you know what I can do? Not that I have an interest in serving in that position, but I have an interest in serving the country. And
right.
the purpose that I could serve would be to create a more informed electorate. So what I spent the year doing is going around the country, giving audiences of a wide variety of demographics and political orientations and so forth the opportunity to have an open Q&A with a legitimate presidential candidate, not one who could win, but one who had actually studied the issues and didn't need to be prepped, didn't need to have the issues narrowed, and allow them to have that exchange so they would at least once in their life know what that feels like and perhaps would change the way they vetted candidates going forward.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point, too, about how we tell the candidates or their people, tell the candidates how to dress, how to talk, and everything else. And I think that's what really, ruined it for Sarah Palin, because they took this person who was someone that everybody liked. They felt that she was very genuine and felt that she would speak her mind. And they told her, don't talk, don't be yourself when you get out there with John McCain. And I think that pretty much just sort of sealed it there for them not winning. I mean, other reasons, of course. But, I mean, for her, I think it was a poor representation to the American public of like, who is this person? We knew you this way, and now you're somebody else. So, and we have somebody who's very great, at reading a teleprompter, but that's about it. We have that already in the White House.
Well, you have to think of how the parties select their candidates. They're looking for people who will capitulate to the party direction. When you see the president, the current president, and even his predecessors, when they can't give a speech without what I call human wallpaper behind them, that carefully orchestrated image of people who almost reflect a bobblehead type presence. They're smiling, their heads are going up and down, nodding in affirmation, and they're selected for their racial diversity, their ethnicity, their sexual diversity, and so forth. Why can't the leader of the free world stand up and deliver the message without anything
right.
behind he or she, other than perhaps an American flag. But we've kind of given into that, and we start looking at it. One of the things that's interesting is when you consider an independent leader. The independent leader is insulated from the influences of money and the influences of a party. They can serve. I used to tell people on the campaign events and on the radio and on television and so forth. I actually had the opportunity to be the United States' first full-time president. Now think about that.
Right.
Because what happens is when a party candidate is put in that position, the presidency has, in effect, evolved into a trophy. And it's paraded around the country for two purposes, to generate votes and to raise money. You look at the president's schedule last week. If you go to whitehouse.gov on any given week, you can see what the president's schedule is. And during non-election years, presidents will spend anywhere from 50% to 75% of their time doing campaign speeches on behalf of their party, for their party's platform, raising money on behalf of the party and other candidates, and then perhaps the most fraudulent activity they engage in, they'll fly across the country to throw their arm around somebody running for governor or mayor or whatever the case may be that they've just met, extol the virtues of the person, tell everybody in the audience, you need to vote for Sam or whomever. And the only reason they do that is because if Sam called that press conference on his own, there are 50 people in the room. The president shows up, there are 500 to 5,000, and that's more money and more votes. But the enormous waste of productivity is astounding, and it's all done at taxpayer expense. So what if you had a person, let's say the current president, as some people like to say, is the smartest man in the room. Let's say somebody like you or somebody like me is only half as smart, but we spend 100% of our time rather than 25% of our time doing the job. It makes us twice as effective.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, what you did in effect is what the founding fathers foresaw that you should do. It's not that you were supposed to go out and put on a show. You were supposed to go out and really and truly tell the American people what you could do for them and what you were going to do to help them. And it wasn't about going out and shaking hands and, you know, well, here I am and, like, you know, bussing people in to be with you and pretend that you're, you know, this really popular guy or woman, you know, whichever one. It was never meant to be that way. It was supposed to be somebody who came forward, who looked at it as, this is something I want to do for my country because I love my country, and this is how I can help you. Not, you know, how can I stay here for 30 years and draw a pension and get insider trading deals? You know, so what you did was something unique that hadn't been done in, you know, however many years, 200 years or something. I don't know.
Well, it was interesting to get the feedback, too. One of the more poignant moments at the end of almost every presentation, particularly on college campuses, where the students are taken for granted. And instead, we went out and respected them. We engaged them. We had the open Q&A. We addressed any issue they wanted and so forth. One of the comments that was so touching, they would approach afterwards for the obligatory handshake, thank you for coming.
Right.
And so many of them would look at me and make the comment, I wasn't going to vote. And it was always for one of two reasons, because there wasn't anyone I could believe in or there wasn't anyone that I could trust.
Yep.
And then they would say, now I'm going to vote. And I kind of look at them, I'd smile, usually, you know, put my hand on their shoulder. I said, you know, this isn't going to end well, right? You're under no delusion that I'm going to win, correct? Because they're going to spend $1 billion to make sure nobody hears of me. And to a person, they always came back and said, I don't care.
Yeah.
My vote counts this year. And that was, without question, the most touching part of our interaction on the campaign trail, is seeing people whose fundamental beliefs may have shifted, maybe for the rest of their lives, in the way they view candidates. And they saw that being able to believe in someone with solutions as opposed to the sound bites, and being able to put their trust in somebody, and that to see the respect mirrored for them was just overwhelming.
Right. And you don't know that there could have been one person in that audience, wherever you were, that really took it to heart and may be someday the next president who actually comes in to do the job, who maybe is Republican or Democrat or whatever party exists at that time, and really is a genuine individual. And so, you know, and that's a good thing. And it also shows you how starved people are for the truth. They want to have genuine people who are telling them the truth and not just feeding them a line.
Well, I think you're spot on. What's lacking among most candidates today, other than preparation, is authenticity. Everything is orchestrated and carefully orchestrated to achieve a marketing objective, as opposed to doing what's in the best interest of the people. You know, everybody's driven by what's in the best interest of the party. And that's not fundamentally how this government is supposed to be crafted. The people are sovereign in our democratic republic. It's not the government that's sovereign. The government is supposed to secure our liberties and our rights,
right,
our God-given rights. And we've lost sight of that. So what we do, we parade people who have been crafted in a way that represents a particular image, and people who are willing to read whatever's posted in front of them in return for the fact that somebody has footed the bill for the auction that they win, because frankly, we aren't having elections. We're having auctions, and
right,
it's going to go to one of the two highest bidders. And what we've got to do is break that behavioral conditioning with some authenticity. These parties have for decades been spending billions of dollars trying to condition people to believe that there are only two choices. And how many times have you heard, and particularly during presidential elections, well, sure, you can vote for this other person, but even if they're the best candidate, they can't possibly win, so you'll just be wasting your vote.
Right.
Well, that's a negative reinforcement, and they do that for a reason. It's to preclude legitimate competition. And the best way to test that is, what's the bigger waste? Is the bigger waste having actually vetted the candidates, identified whom you believe has the best solutions for you and for the country, and then having the courage to cast that vote, even if that person may not have the highest probability of success? Or is it a bigger waste to simply surrender your vote to the parties because they've convinced you your vote only counts if you give it to them?
Right. And you know, we spend so much money in smear campaigns, you know, which has really nothing to do with anything. And half the smear campaigns are false. And so, you know, right off the bat, you have somebody that, again, you know, the authenticity is not there. You don't have the genuine person that you're, you know, why do you want somebody in office that's already lying to you before they even get elected?
Well,
and that's what the smear campaign is. Yeah, exactly.
They're just practicing on a campaign trail. It makes it easier when they're actually elected then.
Exactly. And then they can do a lot of executive orders, you know, and anything else that they want to do. You know, you had talked about, too, on your website about the greatest misrepresentation. And you said those words started out with, you know, when I am elected president, I will repeal, enact, overturn, et cetera. Tell us a little bit about what you meant by that.
Well, I, you know, just jokingly say, although tongue firmly planted in cheek, because there's always a grain of truth with any good sarcasm or satire. Some of the greatest lies of our time have started with the words, and it's not restricted to the president, just when I'm elected, I will. Now, what's interesting is that, particularly with regard to presidents, how many times did you hear, let's take the Republican candidate. Because we'll probably get to beat up on the Democratic winner, but at some point in time. But the Republican candidate, how many times did you hear the Republican candidate say, on the first day I'm in office, I will repeal Obamacare?
Yes.
Well, good luck with that, because there's this problem called the Constitution. And there's a distinction, or at least there used to be until the executive orders started streaming through, where the legislative authority singularly rested and resided with the legislative branch. So anybody who's telling you that on their first day, they will repeal this or pass this bill and so forth. Either is lying to you, or they fundamentally don't understand the Constitution and therefore really aren't competent to serve in that position.
Yeah, or they have the intention, what we've seen, that the Constitution is no longer a valid document. Let's just kind of ignore it. That's old law, and let's move on to something else. We'll just make it up as we go. That seems to be a kind of a trend that we see today. And, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, about the executive order that Obama has in regards to immigration, our own California Attorney General Kamala Harris, along with, I think, about 13 other states, have come out and asked the court to let's move forward, let's proceed right now, and have this be valid. Having your attorney background and all that, how do you foresee, that the court may respond to that? Because, if you look at just totally looking at the Constitution, how could this go forward?
Well, as you're aware of, as an attorney, there are ways to accelerate things through the court system, should the court mm-hmm. choose to do that. I'm not so sure they will with regard to this particular issue, because I think it's an issue they'd almost like to have go away. I think it'll take at least 2 years under normal order for this to be elevated to the point where the Supreme Court has to make a final decision. And by that point in time, the person who is extending executive orders, perhaps beyond what they were intended to be, will no longer be in office. So the problem may expire at some point in time. I do think with mm-hmm. the preliminary injunction, that was an appropriate manner in which to pursue the issue. It terminated the ability to bastardize the Constitution and the intent of executive orders and quasi-legislate. It suspended that capability. I'm not so sure, it could have been done through Congress as well. They could defund, but we have a Congress now that doesn't seem to have a backbone on issues mm-hmm. that are critical to the country. And I'm not speaking from a partisan standpoint. I couldn't care less whether somebody is a Republican or a Democrat. But that oath of office in the case of the president, is I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That last phrase, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, doesn't mean you get to do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you disagree with the Constitution, there's this wonderful Article 5, that gives you an appropriate high bar to overcome to be able to change the Constitution, and it shouldn't be able to be changed on a whim, certainly shouldn't be able to be changed on a personal whim. And you can pursue that, but this attitude that Congress doesn't have to stand up for its rights and stand firmly on them under Article 1, or that the president, and this started before this president, by the way, has the ability to expand powers in a quasi-legislative manner, or now almost a direct legislative manner, with mm-hmm. a simple stroke of a pen, and not consider. I mean, the problem we have now, we're also electing a group of individuals whose strategic vision is limited to a 2-year election cycle. If there's only 1 year left, they only look a year ahead. 6 months left, mm-hmm. they only look 6 months ahead. So let's take immigration as an example. After they processed the executive order and they started looking into it, it's a little bit like Nancy Pelosi in reverse, where Nancy says, we have to pass it to know what's in it.
Right.
Well, you have a situation with immigration where the Congressional Research Service just last week filed a memo with the Senate Judiciary Committee, and there had been some prior memos filed by the Congressional Research Service, which is an independent group that externally kind of connects the dots. It takes an executive order, for example, and starts saying, okay, what impact does this have on the law? So if you look at the the effect of what's been termed a deportation amnesty, where the president grants lawful presence status for a period of 3 years. That allowed them to secure work permits for that period of time. Well, there are a couple problems with that. First of all, we found out that within the context of the IRS, that meant that people could apply for tax refunds, not only for the 3 years that they're here, but they could actually go back for, you know, an appropriate period of time that they were in the country but not even filing taxes. And they were
right.
here illegally, violating the law, which says that you can't work in the United States under those conditions. And they're able to file for tax refunds then. So what does the work permit do now that the Congressional Research Service cited this past week? Well, it allows you to get a driver's license. And with the driver's license, you can get a Social Security number. And once you get the Social Security number, you can now apply for Social Security benefits. And you can even get credit for all of the time that you've worked in the United States, even when you were working here illegally. And that's an indication where it may have felt good from a political standpoint, and it may have been accretive to the platform of the president's party to be able to try and secure the Hispanic base by coming out and acting as if the opposition is totally against you, I'm for you, I'm going to grant you this amnesty. But no one connected the dots. No one looked and said, what's the cascading impact of this? And that's where we fall short, and we do this all the time.
Well, and I wonder if maybe on the other side of that argument is that somebody did connect the dots, and that's what they wanted to have happen. And, you know, there's a lot of people who believe that, you know, it's done to bring America down and just keep on, you know, bankrupting America and not really caring about what's going to happen.
Yeah, I can certainly see somebody making that argument. I don't necessarily share that opinion. I think we're giving perhaps too much credit, because what we've got are people that are serving in office who are kind of doing on-the-job training and leadership. And they don't have 20, 30 years of leadership experience.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the president was a community organizer. The president
right.
never ran an organization, never had P&L responsibility, never really had to be put in a decision support scenario whereby the first thing you do is define the problem correctly, then you identify the root cause, and unlike in politics, where you can only defend a root cause that doesn't reflect negatively upon your party, so that takes away some of the truth associated with resolving the problem, then you go forward once you've defined those root causes and you assess the alternatives. Well, again, in the political world in which we live, because the people are required to pay back their parties and defend their party position, well, they can only look at half the alternatives because they can't possibly give a win to the other side, and it doesn't matter whether it would give a win to the people. But then they get to the critical point where they should be assessing the negative potential negative alternatives and building their responses. So in other words, if our assumptions prove to be inaccurate, then what do we do? And they should
right.
be ready to go. And that experience isn't there, and I'll give you a specific example. When you look at what's transpiring in our foreign policy, when you see the disruption in the Middle East, what has been the one common thread? Every time there's been some disruption, we're going to put together a coalition. Well, the operative phrase is going to.
Yep.
These are all things that an experienced leader would have anticipated. What happens if, for example, if we withdraw from Iraq and the quote-unquote democracy that we've established begins to disintegrate, and that vacuum begins to become filled by someone else, that void fills up rather quickly, what is our position? Well, why not, knowing that that's going to come, that day's going to come, probably, why not be prepared for it? So why not, before you withdraw, actually have a coalition in place with responses already planned, so that if and when an ISIS or enters into the picture, you've got a mass of countries in the Middle East that are committed to the way to quash that insurgency.
Well, and I think that's a good point. And I think this administration has kind of shown over and over, or at least it's the impression I get, is that the military, is kept out of the conversation. It's kind of like the civilians in the administration kind of go in and sit down and do that, strategic planning, if you will, maybe war planning, if you will. And they don't have the experience, even if they were experienced individuals in their field. They don't have the same knowledge that the military has. And, when you're getting rid of most of your military and firing your generals and all these people at the top, you don't have those people sitting in and sort of telling you, you got to think about this. And if this happens, you got to go do this. It's kind of like they're out there saying, oh, we can do it. We don't really need them. So we're not going to, get advice from them. I mean, at least that's how I perceive it. Could be wrong about that.
No, I think you make a very valid point. I suppose my disappointment comes, and again, it comes from leadership experience. I surrounded myself with a very diverse group, and it wasn't based on diversity per se, as you see in a perfunctory sense of our political groups. It was diversity of thought, and you should surround yourself with people who are not going to bow down to you, but people who are going to push back and stand their ground. And I guess what I found most disturbing, we have had some people with experience serving in the position, let's use defense as an example, Secretary of Defense. How many have we had step down without saying anything while they were serving, at least publicly? They were their good stewards, and then they write their memoir, months after leaving. And then they castigate the president for not listening to them and not doing this and not doing that. It's like you were the Secretary of Defense. It was your responsibility to stand up for the truth. And if that was the problem, rather than waiting and, serving years and then waiting to step down or being pushed out because you started to push back internally, stand up, report to the people you truly report to, which is the American public. Tell them the truth.
And I think that's where money was more important to that person and their, what they were going to do in their career and all that. That was more important to them than the truth. And I think that's, more and more people are going to have to start kind of looking at that and making those decisions, which is more important, And I can understand them, having a little bit of being resistant to saying, gosh, I'm just going to go in there because, it means you're going to lose your job. And they've shown time and time again where, whistleblowers go in and they actually do lose their jobs. And if you work for the Pentagon, you never work again, So I get it. But at the same time, if you answer to a higher power, I guess, and my belief that you would make the right decision, and that is, you have to opt for the truth and what's best for the country. That comes first. And I do hope in the future more people do step up and start doing that.
Well, again, it goes back to integrity. And unfortunately, I think that's a characteristic that we fall short on far more often than not in today's political environment. And we've grown acceptance of that. We don't push our leadership to demonstrate true integrity. When you think about it, the only common phrase with every federal oath, and I've written a number of articles on this, because I think it's the ultimate solution. If people took their oath responsibly and they meant it when they said it, they understood it, number one, and they meant it, and perhaps they would even be willing to sign like an ethics agreement that says, if I violate that trust, I will step down from office. You won't have to worry about, pushing me out of office. I will step down the day that there's proof that I violated that. The only common phrase is defend the Constitution of the United States. Whether you're a federal judge, whether you're a member of the military, any elected official, whether it's Congress or the Senate, or you're the president or the vice president, or you're a member of the cabinet, that's the oath, defend the Constitution of the United States. So if you're doing something that is incongruent with the Constitution of the United States, you are dishonoring your oath. And that
mm-hmm.
should be immediate grounds for removal. And I
absolutely.
Don't care what the office is.
Nope, I absolutely agree. And I think that, you know, maybe somewhere in there we need to start, you know, putting amendments in there. I guess the fear or the concern is that we won't have anybody serving at that point, but we have a real problem, and we have to do something about it.
You know, Susan,
ask,
you touched on one other thing that I just wanted to comment on. You talked about whistleblowers and how,
uh-huh.
you know, that's created a fear because they're removed from office. Generally speaking, it's only whistleblowers at a low level.
Ah, okay. That makes a difference.
It's such a protective fraternity that they have at the upper echelons. When you start looking at things like Fast and Furious and so forth, well, a few people lost their jobs. They were insignificant. And the
yeah.
investigation basically terminated. And then when it starts turning towards a higher level and towards a cabinet position, what happened? Well, you had a White House that had disclaimed any knowledge or any communication allowing executive privilege to be claimed. Now, help
right.
me understand that paradox.
Yeah. Well, they learn everything in the news, so, you know, they get away with everything. Now, I want to ask you, too. You work, you're commentating on at One America News Network. Can you tell people who are listening that aren't familiar with who they are a little bit about One America News Network?
Sure. It's a really interesting network. They do nearly 24/7 news. And this isn't because I'm there, because generally speaking, I'm pro bono when I go in and speak as a commentator there. So I don't have a direct business relationship with them at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think fundamentally they're old school news. They report the facts. They get, I think the number is 4 times as many stories per hour as the more classic traditional news media. And what they do is they trust you to be intelligent enough to form your own opinion. Now,
right.
their opinion shows are skewed to the right. They're conservative-based. But to their credit, like the one that I do on every Monday, and then occasionally I do another show, which I know you did just recently, the Rick Amato Show.
Right.
I do the Daily Ledger, which is hosted by Graham Ledger, probably 2.5 decades of media experience in the news, and they will have guests on who are to the left, to the right, and people like me who couldn't care less about political persuasions and only want to focus on the facts. And so they're very respectful. What you're used to seeing, even on the opinion side where the hosts tend to be a bit skewed, they respect your opinion. They don't talk over you. They don't shout you down. When they agree, they agree. When they disagree, they disagree. And it's all done in a very collegial manner, as I think you experienced when you were on Rick's Grassroots Citizen panel.
Absolutely.
And so it's a very unique news format, but particularly the news format. It's very much like the old BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my go-to channel now for news. Because I can turn it on, watch it for a shorter period of time, and get a global perspective, not just a local or a national, but I get a global perspective, so I have a much better understanding of what's transpiring across the world from different perspectives, because they're just reporting it factually. And they have gone from, you know, a startup July 2 years ago. They are now the number 4 cable network in news. So they are just behind Fox, CNN, MSNBC. They are ahead of the BBC. They are ahead of Al Jazeera and a flock of others that are out there. But they've had just meteoric rise. And when you get the opportunity to watch news, unfortunately, it's only it's only carried by AT&T or Verizon. So if you don't have those services, you can't watch One America News. But if you get the chance to watch that news and you really want facts, you're not going to go back to the networks.
And it's absolutely true because, you know, I unfortunately don't get to see them on TV either, but I think their website is OANN.com. And
yes.
When I was there, I mean, they had guests that were, you know, very conservative, some middle of the road and others far left. And it was a total discussion about everything. And they brought in, you know, they had a lot of people they brought in and talked about what was going on in the news. And I thought it was very informative and it was really refreshing, you know, to get that type of news again, you know, rather than, you know, 2 seconds of something you could care less about or something just to put on for sensationalism or whatever. I found it was a really good organization and I hope they continue to gain and get on more stations so that we can all get to see it.
Well, they've been very kind. If you go to the archives on my website, there's a video library. And generally speaking, within about a week or so, the segments that I do are there, so you can get a flavor for what we do. And I have kind of moved from the way we address issues. For the first year and a half, they had me be very serious on camera. And we did deep dives into issues and so forth, as much as you can in you know, a 6 to 8 minute segment. But,
right.
You know, single issue, deep dive, very focused and very serious attempt to distinguish the facts and to perhaps propose a solution. Then they opened it up recently, and because I used to do political satire as well, and now we have a little more fun with it. So we do about, 3 to 4 issues. When I go in, Graham will bring something up, and I'll respond to it. And part of it will be tongue-in-cheek, but we're trying to make our point as well. And so we have quite a bit of fun on it. And the Grassroots Citizens panel is that way, too. You have a lot of fun in the interchange on that particular
right.
panel. So it's a very interesting news network, and the opinion shows are a lot of fun as well.
Give us your website address so we can go there.
Sure, it's really difficult. It's my name. It's TJOHARA.com.
That's going to be so hard to remember, right? No, and I encourage everybody to go there because, again, to see all that you do, but also to see you on the One America News Network and get some, you know, real news. And I wanted to ask you, too, you know, your opinion, what's been going on in the news with, you know, the Congress, the 47 members of Congress writing the letter to Iran. What did you think about that in regards to the nuclear talks between the president and Iran and then Congress coming in and writing this letter to kind of basically, I guess, stop the negotiations and bring it back to the Congress? What did you think about that?
Yeah, it's interesting, and this is the type of discussion that I think is lacking in media in general, because usually it's polarized. Somebody will, you know, if it's an MSNBC, they're likely to tragically attack the people who wrote that letter. Conversely, if it's Fox, they're likely to extol the virtues of that, and it's just exactly what they needed to do because the president was acting without authority and so forth. I take people back to the Constitution. And under the Constitution, whether you like it or not, Article 2 gives the president the opportunity to negotiate these without legislative direction, necessarily legislative direction, unless it's in the form of a treaty, in which case it requires 2/3 of the Senate for approval. This has
right.
been going on for well over 200 years. Conversely, we have a First Amendment, and people are allowed to say whatever they want. They're allowed to do whatever they want as long as it doesn't incite riot or, you know, fighting words doctrine and those types of things, the exceptions to the First Amendment. And do I think, and now I'm going to put my personal opinion forward, not that it's merited, but I'll share it with you. Do I think it was well advised? No. And
right.
I'll say no for two reasons. Not that they didn't have the right to do it. Not that the message they were delivering isn't accurate, because the message is accurate. The legislative branch does have the ability at some point in time to either defund commitments or create a law that would be in contravention to it and so forth. But there's a structure to that. So that was all they were trying to do rather than be disruptive or grandstand to a degree. Then I would say, okay, no harm, no foul. But the problem is, whether or not you think we have a particularly effective negotiation team, and that's a whole different discussion.
Right. I
do think it was disruptive. And I also think from a political standpoint, it was stupid. And what I mean by that is planning what the counter is going to be is very, very important. So while it may have been disruptive, it gives Iran, first of all, a way out. Let's presuppose for a second, just give the benefit of the doubt, that the administration was going to at least make some progress. Maybe not the best deal in the world, as Netanyahu pointed out the other day. Maybe not the best world for the Middle East. But it would create some change that perhaps for some period of time would at least allow us to go back and revisit the issue and maybe mitigate the speed with which Iran could become a nuclear force. We don't know. And to the degree that it gives Iran an out to say, well, we're backing away from the table, now we've lost any opportunity to craft even a decision, a bad negotiation. Conversely, it gives the Democratic Party tremendous ammunition to attack the Republican Party, not on the merits of what was said in the document and was it consistent with the Constitution, which I think it was, but for the fact that they have a very short memory, by the way. They forget when John Kerry did it back in the Reagan administration with regard to Nicaragua. They forget when when Nancy Pelosi did it with respect to Syria. They conveniently forget all these times. Ted Kennedy did it during the Nixon administration. They forget that, but luckily for them, so do Americans. We don't have a terrific grasp of political history, but it gives them the near-term advantage to be able to attack the Republicans once again as obstructionists.
Well, and the way I looked at it, I did a little research on that, and you're right exactly what the law and the Constitution holds, but I did a little bit of looking at what the Founding Fathers really kind of wanted to see, and they really did want to see the Congress and the President working together, especially on something that was so huge as this nuclear agreement would be. Now, there's no law that says you have to, but that was the intent. That's what they wanted to see. And for me, I think that where I fault Congress for what they did is stop talking to another country about what you want done when you need to be talking to the president and working with the president, and they need to, you know, the president needs to be working with Congress. So that was my fault, faulting them in writing to Iran. I disagree with that vehemently because I don't think you should go. It's kind of like if you're in a company and you're having an argument, you know, with the different leaders of the company. You don't go outside of that company and air your dirty laundry, is the way I look at it. You try to, you know, you do whatever you have to do to work it out within that company to make it strong, or in this case, within the country to make it strong. And you don't go outside of Iran and say, oh, you know what, if you enter into that agreement, it's only going to last as long as he's in as president. It's airing dirty laundry, and I think it gave America another black eye. I don't care what the Democrats think about us, and because they always do the same stuff. You know, the left always, comes after and smears the Republicans and vice versa. So I don't care about that. I do care about what it made the country look like. And I think it was sort of, they should have thought that through a little bit better before doing that. That was, kind of my thoughts in that area.
They had too narrow a horizon that they were looking at. They were looking at, I think, they were looking at the press they could get out of standing up to the president or however they perceive this to be an intelligent strategy. And you're exactly correct. The discussion that the American people deserved was a debate on the merits in America, among Americans. And they also provided a release of pressure, if you will, where you had every bit as truculent and childish behavior on the part of Democrats who refused to listen to a world leader from the Middle East when they had the opportunity to hear.
Right.
And then Nancy Pelosi had made comments about it, you know, almost drove her to tears. She was saddened, you know, by the insult to the intelligence of the United States and saddened by the condescension towards our knowledge of the threat posed by Iran and all. You know, she was almost in tears. Excuse me?
I know. She reminds me more of
please.
Betty
you know,
Davis
so we have
the
childish behavior. And if the Republicans wanted to really do something constructive, they would have hammered on the facts and said, this is what the Prime Minister said. Do you agree or do you disagree? This
right.
is what we have said. Do you agree or do you disagree? And go down, you know, maybe the 10 top points and have an intelligent debate. And the Democrats, who, you know, took their ball and went home when he came in and acted like it was a protocol insult. Seriously? So a nuclear Iran is less important than maintaining protocol. Is that what we're saying here? I mean, it would have been embarrassing if somebody would have had a grown-up discussion about the points, and instead the Republicans thought, well, they're stomping their feet and holding their breath. How can we do that too? And then the people trying to unwind it, coming back and saying, well, I thought it was kind of just done as a joke. And the other person who came back and said, well, I was rushing to get a plane because the snow was coming. I was trying to beat the snow out of D.C. Oh, and you signed a letter to the leadership of Iran and you didn't read it? This, I mean, we're not even, you know, that's not even Nancy Pelosi ignorant. It's not 2,700 pages. We're talking one page here, and the person didn't read it and they signed it? Come on.
Or they don't want to own up to it afterwards. I mean, we have a lack of leadership, I think, just all the way around, and I think it really is showing and has shown for the last, you know, 6+ years. You know, that we're not a group that's together, whether inside the Republican Party or, you know, together. We have about a minute, a little bit more than a minute left, and I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. It's been a real pleasure. You know, the time is always flies by. There's so much more that we could have talked about, but I want to, you know, just welcome you back anytime, and we can, you know, continue a further discussion on anything that we sort of left out tonight.
Well, there may have been just a few issues we skipped over, but there's a lot going on in the world. But, Susan, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I really appreciate the invitation to be your guest this evening. I look forward to doing it again sometime soon.
Great, and we'll look forward to going to your website at tjohara.com and then catching you on One America News Network and going to your website to find out more about what you've done on that show. And thank you again, and we'll talk soon.
Sounds great. Thank you, Susan.
Take care. So as we said, there's a lot going on in the news. Tomorrow, as you know, are the elections in Israel for the prime minister to see whether Netanyahu gets reelected or whether there will be a new prime minister, Herzog. He was with Herzog and Levini, I think is the name, or Levini, I can't say that last name. But that person who was a member with Herzog stepped down this afternoon from what I understand in the news. So now it's just Herzog by himself going against Netanyahu. So hopefully the right decision will come out of that, and you know, we'll see what happens with all of that. So until next week, I want everyone to have a great week. Keep up with the news. Go to my website. Again, it's SusanKnowles.com, and hear more articles and news in our past archives. So till next week, I will see you then. Take care.